Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in LA, and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s...
She looked like a million bucks.
...scams a bunch of famous athletes out of untold fortunes...
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
It's just unbelievable.
Hide your money in your old rich man, because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
One hot August afternoon in 2017, Louis Garcia was helping his friend John Cape build a wheelchair ramp for John's girlfriend Rexina at their house in San Antonio.
Suddenly, Bexar County police showed up with a search warrant. They took Louis and John inside, cuffed them, and quickly found a stash of drugs that were hidden in the house.
Body cam footage later showed more drugs on the floor near Louis's feet.
John, Rexina, and Louis were all arrested and charged with drug possession and trafficking. Louis insisted he knew nothing about it. Those drugs on the floor didn't belong to him.
This wasn't even his house.
But his lawyer said it didn't look good. If they went to trial and the jury saw that footage, Louis could be facing 25 years to life. Reluctantly, he pled guilty and got a lighter sentence.
I mean, after all, the drugs were right there on camera. But this is wrongful conviction.
All right, welcome back to Wrongful Conviction. We are guest hosting today. My name is Greg Glaude.
And I'm Clayton English.
You might recognize our voices from the War on Drugs podcast that Clayton and I co-host. And, you know, we're really excited to share the story that we have for you today on Wrongful Conviction.
Yes.
Because I really think it aligns with a lot of things that we're talking about there. You know, perverse incentives within the criminal justice system, within the drug war that lead to devastating consequences. And in the case that we have today, an actual wrongful conviction. There really isn't a greater example than Louis Garcia, who was the subject and victim of wrongful conviction in the San Antonio area of Texas. So we have Louis here, and we also have his attorney, Dana Jones. Guys, thank you so much for being on the Wrongful Conviction podcast.
Thank you
so much for having us.
Yeah, and let's just kind of get into it a little bit. Louis, let's talk about prior to the incident here back in 2017. You know, where were you born? Where'd you grow up?
I was born in San Antonio. I went to school. I played ball. I lifted a lot of weights. And, you know, just enjoying myself, dating off and on.
Any minor run-ins with the law, things like that?
I've had run-ins with the law before. And it's just, you know, like when you're in your early 20s and you start drinking alcohol. So yeah, I've had some run-ins with the with the authorities, and I can say I've learned some of my lessons.
Typical stuff for being a young adult, like you said, you start drinking, you're irresponsible at that age, you get pulled over for taillights, tags, and then something else goes on. But it's not like this was your life or you were in and out of the system before.
No, I was a licensed electrician. Right. I had a real good job. I was running jobs. I was doing everything, you know, I was going down a good path.
Like, so when all of this went down, August of 2017, you were like, what, 45 years old?
Yeah.
You were living in San Antonio, working, you know, doing your thing, electrician work. And you were friends with a couple of your neighbors, John Cape and Rexina Linan Juarez, who lived across the street.
Yeah. My neighbors are great. Sometimes I barbecue, sometimes they do, and we'll send plates back and forth. I'm the kind of guy that you invite to the barbecue and bring your tools.
Right.
So I'm like, oh, okay. So I'm always out, you know, having a good time.
Gotcha. And Rexina, who also went by Mona, you helped her out a lot. You know, she had lost her legs to diabetes. She was in a wheelchair. And in fact, this one day you had actually seen her fall off her ramp to get into her house because the ramp was in, you know, pretty rough shape, right?
Yeah. Then I go across the street and start helping her up. And I started looking at this little, you know, whatever you want to call it that was built. It was just a bunch of scrap wood put together. And I looked around and I told her, you know, Mona, I'll help you build all this up and clean your fence up.
And you were like, hey, let me get this together so this won't happen again. And
yeah. And so I had extra plywood, like 2x4s and a lot of stuff out there that we could have, we were going to build her a better ramp. And she was excited about it, but she kept on telling me, I can't pay you. And I told her, you know, well, on the first of the month when you get your food stamps, you know, I'm a real sucker for some chicken mole. And
right.
She goes, oh, I can make that. I said, we'll be good.
Hey, man, listen, a home-cooked meal, sometimes that's more than enough for a hard day's work. So that's what you and Mona's boyfriend, John Cape, were up to that day. August 10th, 2017, you were out in front of their house. You're building a new wheelchair ramp. And Mona had gone off to the dollar store to, you know, grab some snacks and some Gatorade for you guys, right?
Yeah. And while we were, you know, putting everything together, I don't know who the guy was, but John was communicating with him, and he told him that, hey, do you mind if my daughter uses the restroom? She had a pink backpack with her. And they go inside. John comes right back out with me, and we're taking stuff apart. And they leave. And another thing that caught my eye is she didn't have a backpack this time.
So this guy who you didn't know and daughter has a backpack come up and say, hey, just need to use the restroom. You guys are just being good hosts and let them in.
What?
Daughter comes back out, no backpack on her.
No backpack.
On the way back out. Yeah.
And as soon as you hear their car take off up the block, and I looked up and I just see a Bexar County Sheriff sticker on the side of a van, and everybody starts jumping out. And I tell John, hey, man, we're in a raid, dude.
So, Dana, let me throw it to you for some background here. Can you kind of run through the facts of the case? Like, what's going on at this point? I mean, you know, the listener, like, why are the cops even here?
So, Bexar County Narcotics Division, it goes and gets a search warrant for the house where Louis happened to be. Louis did not live there at all. They relied on a confidential informant to get into this particular house with really nothing corroborating the confidential informant's information at all. This confidential informant had never been relied on before. How they made this person credible in the affidavit was that they had conducted a controlled buy for the officer. The officer says he met with the informant, gave the informant an undisclosed amount of U.S. currency, dropped the informant off down the road, and observed the informant go into a location. Then they later picked up the informant, and he had drugs.
Wow. No, I'm just saying that the informant had never been used as a CI or anything before.
First time.
And they're just going off somebody's word who essentially you dropped them off somewhere, you saw them go in a place, and later on they had drugs, and you equate that to them being credible. That's crazy.
I mean, that doesn't even prove that the person knows what drugs are. They just went in there and said, here's money, give me meth. And then they're like, they came back with meth. They must know what it is. But that's essentially what it was. That's the credibility there. That information got police lawfully into a house. I mean, lawfully in the sense of that's the paperwork. The judge signed off on this, got them into a house, took people down, searched their house, made arrests based on that.
And, you know, this is the kind of problem that we see with a lot of these warrants. And Clayton, I'm sure you're thinking what I'm thinking. Yep. We did an episode of the War on Drugs podcast called The War at Your Door on no-knock warrants.
Yeah.
And this is not a no-knock warrant, but it has a lot of those similarities to it. It kind of has that same feel, right?
Yeah, no, it definitely has that no-knock feel. It reminds me of what Radley Balco talked about on our episode that we had of our...
Yeah. No, it feels exactly like that. And really, you know, judges are supposed to be this check on a lot of these warrants, and they kind of rubber stamp them quite a bit. And you really look at a lot of the evidence that comes to allow the government just to barrel into your door, not announcing themselves, and how shoddy and minor that is. And then you look at a case like this, and you're using an untested, untrained confidential informant that has all the incentive of the world to essentially do things to get themselves off. And you're rubber stamping these things and the consequences of that. I think it's just, it's a pretty scary, scary circumstance. It's one that, you know, we could all find ourselves in. You know, Louis was just doing a good deed for a neighbor, and look at the circumstances that he found himself.
Yeah. Justice being served out in the name of a lie is scary anyway.
Exactly.
All right. So, Louis, let's wind it back a minute. You and John are building the ramp. The guy and his daughter come in, use the bathroom, and take off. And police show up in a hot second with this warrant. What happened next?
They started cuffing us up, and they secured the location. And I had been cuffed from the back like everybody else does, and I was already on the floor. Well, I look up, and I just an officer comes, and he jumps on top of me. And he messes up my right shoulder. And, you know, I can't lift it up over my shoulders right now. And I was like, man, what'd you do that for, man?
So almost immediately they go back to the bathroom and they come back and they're like, what's this? With a huge, large quantity of drugs. And that's exactly where this guy and his little girl with the backpack had just gone. And they supposedly found it between, like, there was like a loose board in the wall and like in a hole. And that's where they found it.
Wow. So was this, we don't know about these people. Are they, because I'm going to say what it looks like and what it sounds like is this dude came in with his daughter and planted drugs in there.
So I'm just sitting there and everything. And then they pointed me out and said, hey, is that your drugs on the floor? And I was, I don't have, y'all guys been looking at me the whole time. My hands have been handcuffed. And so they jump on me again. And there was some narcotics that were found on the floor. And they were saying it's mine. I was like, I said, no, it's not, man. It's not mine.
What he's talking about is when they handcuffed him, they led them, and it's on body cam, into a, inside to sit on a couch. And you can kind of see the general area. There's an officer sitting with them the entire time. You don't see anything on the ground. He's handcuffed the entire time. And when they stand him up to leave, there's all of a sudden like a little bit of drugs sitting on the floor next to him that was not there before. I don't know how he could be sitting on a couch with his hands behind him and
next to a police officer
and somehow get, I mean, the implication to me when I was reading the reports was he somehow pulled these out of his pockets or something, but they were accusing him of having this small quantity sitting next to him on the floor.
Oh, wow.
That wasn't there when he sat him down.
Okay. And then right about then, that's when Roxina came back from the dollar store and saw everything that was going on.
So she came back to the raid.
She came back in the middle of the raid.
So she came back, police there, you in cuffs.
And she sees, like, she starts cussing them out. What the hell are y'all doing in my house? Is that, you know, she might be in a wheelchair, but she's going to stand her ground.
Sure.
And she tell them, get the hell out of my house. I don't know who y'all are. And she, Bear County Sheriff's, and handed her the warrant. And she knows she's in cuffs.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
A new season of Bridgerton is here. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabrielle Collins, and this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Colin Bridgerton has returned from his travels abroad. Is betrothal written in the stars for the eligible bachelor? Meanwhile, the ton is reverberating with speculation of who holds Lady Whistledown's pen. We're discussing it all. I sit down with Nicola Coughlin, Luke Newton, Shonda Rhimes, and more to offer an exclusive peek behind the scenes of each episode of the new season. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix. Then, fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to catch a new episode every Thursday.
Are you ready to fight back against crime? Hi guys, Nancy Grace here, host of podcast Crime Stories with Nancy Grace. I've dedicated my life to fighting crime and helping crime victims. For a decade, I prosecuted violent felonies, personally investigating, prosecuting, and covering literally thousands of cases. It's so easy to think it will never happen to me or my family, but that is simply not true. Every day on Crime Stories with Nancy Grace, we shine a light on unsolved homicides, heat up cold cases, and help find missing people, especially children. We speak with family members, investigators, CSI, reporters, and experts in every field. Every day is a mission. Every day is a chance to stop crime and keep one more person safe. Listen to Crime Stories with Nancy Grace on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
They were Bexar County Narcotics Division, were the officers. Interesting enough, just a side piece of information is this is not my first case overturning a Bexar County narcotics case. Like years ago, this same division, they had some lying officers who were in trouble in the same unit who were just kind of making up information and on search warrants and got in trouble.
I was going to ask that. Like, they have a little bit of history of being dirty.
At least with me, they do. I mean, not every officer is bad. I can put that out there. But I haven't had a good, really positive experience in my career with that particular unit.
Right. And there's been a history, yeah, like you said, within Bexar County. I know back in March 2010, there was, you know, I think 239 warnings to defense attorneys whose cases evolved to narcotics deputies, and they're accused of pocketing, you know, money that was supposed to be paid to CIs. And like you said, there's been other cases there. And so this is something, I don't know if the term systemic, but there has been a routine within Bexar County of this types of stuff going on within their narcotics division, correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
So each one of them was charged with 4 to 200 grams, I believe, is what the ultimate charge ended up being, with the intent to deliver, which in Texas, that elevates it up to another offense level, range of punishment, everything.
So I went to go see the lawyer, and I told him, man, look, Roxana, she gave me an affidavit stating that it's her house, everything is found on the property, and she's solely responsible for it. He looked at that thing, and he was like, you don't live there. They searched your stuff. There was nothing found on your person. He goes, I'm taking this all the way to trial. This is immediate dismissal. Oh, man. That was a court appointed telling me this. Man, I'm high-fiving him. He goes, man, keep your nose clean. Stay out. He goes, you're going to beat your case. So I went hopping home, skipping, happy. I'm go back to working again and helping out and stuff like that. And it wasn't the same when I went to court.
Eventually, your bond got revoked and you were back in jail waiting for these charges. And somehow, I don't know, nobody can figure out, but his lawyers like switched and he didn't have the same lawyer anymore. And he got a new court-appointed lawyer.
He's already telling me, man, it don't look good.
Wait a minute. Whoa. We go from this trial's about to get thrown, the case going to get thrown out, to it doesn't look good.
Yeah. They were 10 years. And I was like, who do you... Are you serious? 10 years from having all this confidence about me getting this case dismissed to this guy looking at me, he's like, well, what can you say? You've been in trouble before. And I'm just,
yeah,
but this isn't mine.
Wow.
You know, in the eyes of the court, you're guilty and you're going to have to sign for something today.
So they immediately wanted you to take a plea.
Yes. And I just put my head down and just, that's when I started like, thinking, like, maybe I need to do this. Maybe I need to do that. Maybe.
Okay.
And it wasn't until this case got opened up about me having these drugs that were found. Come to find out, all these police officers, none of them are credible in court. That's the reason why they didn't want me to take this to trial.
Got you. Wow. Okay. So this goes just going back to what you were saying, they were trying to get you to admit to those drugs in the house. When they put their knee on your chest and everything, they were trying to get admission then. And then when you got the first one, saw it for what it was, that it should be thrown out or whatever. Then they switched it to somebody that told you to take the plea. And it just sounds like what we've talked about, Greg, on our podcast, with that whole system of trying to get people to get through the system as fast as possible, get them the plea. Like, it's almost shock and awe. Like, we're trying to scare you into this, like, you know.
I think there's also something to be said there that when somebody is in custody already, like his bond got revoked, he's in custody, the balance of, well, okay, if I just take the plea and do a little bit of time, I can get out. It's a lot easier to fight charges when you're actually out of jail. You're working with your lawyer. You can have better meetings with them. There's a lot more discussion that way. But when sometimes when you're in custody and you have a lawyer who's like, look, not fighting for you, but they're also not meeting with you because they're not, you're not able to call their office and talk with them. I think Louis and I have talked about this before, just the, okay, well, if they want me to do 10, and he ended up getting 8 years ultimately, but you start running through, I've been in here a little bit of time already. I'm facing life in prison for this amount of drugs. The reality is you never know what a jury is going to do if you can't get your case dismissed. And you start kind of justifying to yourself, okay, I could maybe make parole in a couple years. And those thoughts start going through your mind.
So Louis, now we're over a year and a half out from the actual arrest. You're initially thinking that this is going to get dismissed. Those hopes kind of just start to dwindle. And then you have to accept a plea deal on something that you know in your heart you had nothing to do.
I was told 25 to life if I take this trial. And I'm like, you know, what do you say? It's hard. And you're like, I might beat this one, but this one's over here pending. And what are the chances? And you just put your head down and you just, you know, I have to take this. I have to take what they're offering me. 25 to life each case. And I was like, I know I have a history. It's you know, I've learned from my mistakes. I have been making mistakes. And it's just like, I even told the cops, if you're going to catch me, catch me. Don't do it this way.
Okay. So Louis pled out to serve 8 years in prison. Then there's time served and all that. What about the other two defendants, Mona and John?
So John ended up taking time in prison. I think he got 10 years on his case. And then they call her Mona. Her official name is Rexina. Rexina was very, very ill. So John actually took a little bit more time on his sentence so that Rexina could get probation. That's kind of also another reason that these plea bargains were all offered so that Rexina could get out because of her health problems. And Louis and John recognized that. So Rexina got out, she served her probation, and John and Louis went off to start their sentences.
By the time you get there, you already kind of got your mindset on, you know, how you're just going to tread through. You don't want to get involved. You don't want to stay out of the way, go to the library, read books, do this, that. And that's what you're mostly focused on. You can't sit there and tell yourself that, you know, that what you did was wrong. You sold yourself out, you know. You had nothing to do with this. You know, why'd you do what you did? I'm just here to do my time. That's all in my mind frame. There's a lot of disorder and chaos that goes on in there. And you just don't want no part of it. You don't conversate with certain people. You just leave all this stuff alone. And every now and then you're going to have a clash with these groups or with this or with that. And it's how you deal with it. You just got to keep moving forward. I had a real tough time in there because I had a celly, and, you know, he was 5 years older than I was, and we would talk. And next thing I know, the morning's there, and we would just talk and talk and talk. Well, he was making some hooch when I was at the library, and they fought for the bottle or whatever it was. And, you know, my celly, ended up, you know, he died. He was beaten to death. And it still bothers me today. But
they, do you want me to tell this part, Louis?
Please.
Sorry to hear that.
Okay, so I've heard him tell this before, and it's really heartbreaking. But they basically brought him like a bucket of water and told him to clean up the blood that was in his cell himself. So it's his friend's blood, and he had to clean it all up.
I told him I don't want to go in there. I don't want to go in there. And they said, "Aren't you coming up for parole? You know, I'm giving you a direct order to get inside your cell and do this, do that. You know, you don't want to get in there? you know, okay, you're going to lose your parole next year, to, you know, for the following year. So I put my head down and I cleaned up the blood.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
A new season of Bridgerton is here. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabrielle Collins, and this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Colin Bridgerton has returned from his travels abroad. Is betrothal written in the stars for the eligible bachelor? Meanwhile, the ton is reverberating with speculation of who holds Lady Whistledown's pen. We're discussing it all. I sit down with Nicola Coughlan, Luke Newton, Shonda Rhimes, and more to offer an exclusive peek behind the scenes of each episode of the new season. Watch season three of the Shondaland series on Netflix. Then, fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to catch a new episode every Thursday.
Are you ready to fight back against crime? Hi guys, Nancy Grace here, host of podcast Crime Stories with Nancy Grace. I've dedicated my life to fighting crime and helping crime victims. For a decade, I prosecuted violent felonies, personally investigating, prosecuting, and covering literally thousands of cases. It's so easy to think it will never happen to me or my family, but that is simply not true. Every day on Crime Stories with Nancy Grace, we shine a light on unsolved homicides, heat up cold cases, and help find missing people, especially children. We speak with family members, investigators, CSI, reporters, and experts in every field. Every day is a mission. Every day is a chance to stop crime and keep one more person safe. Listen to Crime Stories with Nancy Grace on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
All right, so Dana, you get involved in this case in 2019. And, you know, there's a parallel case to this that is really tied into Louis. Can you kind of talk about what you discovered between Louis' case and obviously the other case of Ruby Sandoval, which happened in October of that same year in San Antonio, Texas?
Yeah. So when I was asked by the Conviction Integrity Unit and then appointed by the judge to represent them, I did reach out to Louis and John. I just wanted to know what was going on, what their thoughts on their own case were, and saying, I'm looking into this. This is what I've been told so far, but I need to get some information. And both of their letters back finally were kind of the same thing. We've always said that this guy came into the house and he must have planted the drugs because they weren't ours. And it was a really weird situation and nobody believed us, which it matched up with Ruby's case as well. So what I find out later is somebody had messaged her or talked to her about storing like a box or a bag, leaving it at her house for a little while. She said, sure, that's fine. She had a lot of text messages with this person. The person was like, when are you going to be home? When are you going to be home? That kind of stuff. And as soon as she gets home, cops raid her house with a search warrant, and they find drugs in this bag that this person asked to leave at her house. So based on that, she starts immediately fighting her case, and it takes her quite a while to prove to the prosecutor and to everyone, you know, with her lawyer, get her text messages and everything in line to show this person must have left the drugs here. The state now feels comfortable enough that that's what happened in her case. So that prosecutor in her case went to a conviction integrity unit that the DA's office has. They immediately pulled every case that this confidential informant had worked on previously, and it was Louis, Rexina, and John's case. They sent me a memorandum explaining everything that went on and why they think that, you know, what happened in John and Louis' case and Rexina's case might have happened just like it happened in this other woman's case.
Oh, wow. So the same informant. Mm-hmm. So the same playbook of somebody comes by, leaves something there, and then the police come. The same county. Wow. Yeah.
No, okay. It was the same informant, the same situation, same informant. Thankfully, in her case, she had a bunch of text messages from the individual, and she was able to establish all of that.
Okay, gotcha. Okay. What was the, between Rexina and the confidential informant, like, was there a connection? Why was he drawn to this house, even plant things, or was it completely random?
I think that he knew John and Rexina just from the neighborhood, is my understanding. They knew who he was, but that was kind of the extent of it. Louis didn't know who he was at all.
No, I didn't know him.
Wow. And that person used their daughter. Mm-hmm.
It just shows the lengths that confidential informants go to work off their own cases.
Gotcha. So was it readily apparent when you were kind of reading through this and going through, what were some of the things that you feel could have nipped us in the bud earlier? What was the kind of the things that stood out to you the most?
Red flag number one to me was reading this search warrant, that this is the first time they've ever used this confidential informant. I don't think that they had enough to get a search warrant. Based on that, I would have challenged that. The body cam footage, that what I had said earlier, that they're trying to say that these drugs that are near Louis, but they weren't there before. It just,
and if you see the video, it blacks out. They're like, it does turn the camera on and state your name and what's your address. And then it turned it back off. Then it turned it back on and said, these drugs were found right here.
Officers that turn on and off their cameras or mute their mics, always a red flag for me. It just all seemed weird. And when something seems weird or off, there's usually some problems there, is in my opinion. So there's definitely was a lot to work with.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. So you talked about, Dana, a lot of the work that the Bexar County Conviction Integrity Unit has done and the good work that they've done. And they've actually been, you know, a really big bright spot within the prosecutorial's office there. Can you talk about, you know, what their involvement throughout this process with Louis once you got into the case and how that looked?
So initially it was the chief of that office. She's not there anymore. She works for a different court. But Matt Howard is now the chief of the Conviction Integrity Unit. I work with Matt quite a bit. I can't ever say that he and I are going to agree on every case, but I can assure you that he gives everything a thorough review. And if it's a wrongful conviction, he will stand up and say it's a wrongful conviction. He's not afraid to do it. So I really do commend the work. Our DA is Joe Gonzalez. He didn't start the Conviction Integrity Unit, but he's kept it going and really built on it. And they do a great job of overturning wrongful convictions when the proof is there. So in my work, when I filed the claims, I got every claim together that I could possibly file for Louis and John and Rexina. And then I filed them in the writ application, a memorandum of law. From there, I worked with the Conviction Integrity Unit on what facts and details we're going to agree to. And we put those agreed orders together and we get those in front of the judge. And we also had a great judge, Judge Meza, here in town. She agreed on a lot of this. She actually went even further than what the Court of Criminal Appeals was willing to do. Judge Meza recommended that all three of them are actually innocent of the charges. So that's kind of the process especially when we have agreed facts and agreed relief, the DA's office here is willing to get on board, and we file a lot of agreed stuff together, which is unique. As a defense attorney, it does feel weird to give so much credit, but every DA's office, because of situations like this, need conviction integrity units. and true ones that are willing to say our DA's messed up, our sheriff's messed up. So they're willing to make those hard calls in the Conviction Integrity Unit here. And I appreciate the work that they do, especially on this case.
Oh, man, the Conviction Integrity Unit. I think that needs to be implemented everywhere, man. Like that's something that it's a resource I think that can hopefully get a lot more cases overturned, you know?
Yeah, Clayton, I totally agree. And, you know, we're seeing them pop up a lot more and more. And yeah, to your point, we definitely need more oversight on these things. All right. So Dana, as you said, Judge Mesa recommended that Louis and John's convictions be overturned and they should be found innocent. But then it went up to the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. Can you explain what happened next?
Yeah, the Court of Criminal Appeals for John and Louis said no, that they should, their case is overturned, but they're not actually innocent, which it's a really high, difficult burden to prove when actual innocence. So I can go into why they didn't. There, because in John's house, there was some little minor amounts of drugs that were found, like personal use, small amounts like that. And because they said that that's a lesser included of the greater amount, they're not going to give them an actual innocence finding. That's why they went that route. But Louis didn't live there, and there was nothing directly linked to Louis. I really felt like, at least in Louis's case, he should have had the actual innocence finding in this case. So since they don't get an actual innocence, it gets sent back down to the trial court level, and the DA's office immediately filed dismissals in all the cases just to make it official that it's overturned and now dismissed officially. So they don't have a conviction on their record for these cases.
And because they are not found actually innocent, Texas law does not allow them to be entitled to compensation because of that, correct?
Correct.
Wow. Have any officers or anyone else been disciplined that were connected to this case?
Not that I'm aware of.
Was the informant ever charged with anything about lying in this case?
No, not that I'm aware of.
Okay. And so we're now looking into, what, August 2020, Judge Mesa finally fines for wrongful conviction. And then Louis, you're released at the same time as John on bond in September 2020.
Yes, you had like kind of a turn because it sounded like you kind of gave up and just like said, I'm gonna put my head down and do my time and to be walking free, man. What was that like?
It was the meeting my little grandbaby. Playing with her is just... Wow. I just started smiling, like, I'll be there for my parents, you know, I'm the only son. I'm big little brother, and so it's kind of, you know, I'm going to go do what I'm supposed to be doing.
One other little kind of piece of sad part of this whole case is the whole time that I represented Rexina, she was on hospice care because of her illness, and the day that the judge signed these orders for them, like for her case to be overturned, it didn't need to go up to the Court of Criminal Appeals. But the day she signed it, I called the next day after I got the order, and she had passed away the night before. So I never got a chance to tell Rexina her case was overturned.
Oh, man.
Yeah. The first thing that John and Louis did was they were pallbearers at Rexina's funeral.
Damn,
yeah.
Geez. Her sister had told us that she knew that, you know, that y'all guys were going to get out. She was happy we got out. I think about a year into my sentence, she wrote me a letter.
Mm-hmm.
I know with her arthritis, that probably took a lot out of her. So even when I was incarcerated, we still kept in touch.
Mm-hmm.
What little she could say, because it was like, hi, thinking about you, how have you been? And pretty much that's it. You know, I still keep in touch with John. I still keep in touch with Delma, Rexina's sister. Yeah. We're still, like, I guess, easing our way through this and just slowly turning pages and moving forward.
Wow. Just an unbelievable story. I think this case really does exemplify so much that's wrong with our criminal justice system and the war on drugs and how these negative incentives can really, impact people's lives in such a dramatic fashion that, you know, you see where these negative incentives could lie with the confidential informant and where his incentives are drawn from the detectives to garner two more convictions kind of fairly easily without kind of, you know, really respecting someone's constitutional rights. It's such an exemplification of all the negative that we see within the criminal justice system. And the fact that we have, you know, somewhat of a happy ending with Louis, and how many other thousands of people have probably gone through similar things and never got this opportunity to actually be, you know, have their cases dismissed because there wasn't this conviction integrity or there wasn't this piece of evidence. And so, yeah, I just want to thank you, Louis, for coming on today and discuss this case.
Well, that's one thing with our podcast. We don't have a lot of happy endings.
Yeah.
So to have somebody who's actually been through everything and come out the other side, and it's great. So thank you. Thank you both.
Louis, is there any call to action? Is there a GoFundMe page? Is there a number for people could reach out about, you know, you and your skills as an electrician? Anything else with that that we can plug for you?
If anybody needs some help or needs some work or stuff like that, you can go through Dana. It's all right with her.
I'll be your secretary, Louis.
But I mean, you need plumbing, you need electrical, you need to fix your fence, and I ain't going to wash your dogs, but you know, all that other stuff right there. Anything to keep myself busy, to keep myself moving, keep some gas in the truck and a little change in my pocket, I'm fine.
I'm looking at some curtains right now that are crooked because I couldn't do that. And you lifted a whole fucking house by yourself. God damn. It's so worthless.
Man, come on. You got to get your skills up. I take that back. We got to get our skills up. That's a we thing. We got to get our skills up. Yeah, man. Look, we've come to this segment of our show called Closing Arguments. Louis and Dana, thank you so much for being here with us today. This is the last segment of the show. So we turn it over to you two for any final thoughts that you may have for your closing arguments. So Dana, why don't you start us off?
I always say that I would love to not do this job anymore, only because I would love that there's never another wrongful conviction ever. But there's always going to be this job because humans are involved in this process, in this system. The use of confidential informants really needs to be questioned in every single case if they're going to do it. I don't personally think they should be doing it, but I'm not a law enforcement officer. Judges who review search warrant affidavits and arrest warrant affidavits. I mean, the whole process, everybody needs to have better training so that we can catch these things on the front end and prevent them from ever even happening. I just think, I hope, and I love podcasts like this where we're getting the word out that wrongful convictions do happen. They absolutely do happen. And we can't just, you know, incarcerate somebody and turn a blind eye anymore, that we need to start working. So if there's any local organizations, innocence projects in your state or local community, get involved if you can, donate. If you ever get called on jury duty, really take it serious because you could be deciding somebody's fate.
Keep your head up and keep going. You get enough wrong, so you're out there doing right. So, you know, I've had enough wrong done to me. So now it's just, you know, I go out there and help out all I can. And I don't hold any negativity, any grudge or nothing like that. You know, I still have a lot of respect for the law. I still respect, you know, these people that are doing a hell of a job out there. And it wasn't until I was released and I saw all the effort that Dana and the judge Mesa put into getting me out. It's like these people they didn't know me for any date. They didn't owe me anything, but they fought hard to get me out. They fought hard to where I'm at. And so that's, you know, I guess check marks on my side. You know, you do have people looking out after you. Not everybody's there to hang you.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction. We are your guest hosts, Clayton English.
And I'm Greg Glott.
And we'd like to give a shout out to executive producers Jason Flom and Kevin Wardis.
Plus everybody on the Wrongful Conviction production team, Connor Hall, Annie Chelsea, Lila Robinson, and Jeff Kleiber.
The music in the production comes from 3-time Oscar-nominated composer, Jay Ralph.
Be sure to follow us on Instagram at Wrongful Conviction, on Facebook at Wrongful Conviction Podcast, and on Twitter at Wrong Conviction, as well as Lava for Good on all 3 platforms.
You can find us online too. I'm Clayton English on Instagram.
And I'm on Twitter at Greg Glott.
And for more about the state of drug criminalization in your society, listen to the War on Drugs podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Wrongful Conviction is a production of Lava for Good podcast in association with Signal Company No. 1.
Hey,
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in LA, and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s...
She looked like a million bucks.
...scams a bunch of famous athletes out of untold fortunes...
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
It's just unbelievable.
Hide your money in your old Richmond, because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.